Hello and welcome to What a Screen, the horror movie podcast where I, your host, Green, chats with a special guest about horror films. And we discuss two films that have to do with a certain topic or subject that I have previously randomly chosen. So this is going out the couple of days after Christmas, and I hope everyone had a really peaceful festive season. It can be a really hard time for people, so I hope it was at least peaceful. This week, the episode is all about a ghost story for Christmas. Myself and my special guest, Russ Bailey, are chatting about two of the episodes that went out within this strand of short television films that were typically shown at Christmas on the BBC between 1971 and 1978. And then it was revived in 2005 as well. The most recent one just went out. It was done by Mark Gatiss. It had James C. Swanton in it. It was based on the Arthur Conan Doyle story, Lot 249. It was good. I definitely recommend you going to check it out if you can, as well as going back and watching all of the Ghost Story for Christmas entries. You can find them on YouTube. They've also put out like a DVD or a Blu-ray collection of them. So the ones that myself and Russ are going to be talking about today is The Signalman from 1976, which was based on a Charles Dickens story. And then we are also talking about Stigma, which was one of the only like original stories that wasn't like based on an M.R. James story or a Charles Dickens story, and that was released in 1977. So those are the two short films that myself and Russ are talking about. So enjoy. So I would like to welcome back to the podcast. We are welcoming back Russ. How are you?
Hi, I'm pretty good. I'm all right. It's kind of cold here. I had a spooky, frosty walk with my dog this morning at like 7 a.m. So I got quite into the kind of spooky British countryside vibe already. But yeah, I'm all right. I'm good. I'm kind of getting slowly into the Christmas spirit. Mm. I have my ex-moose t-shirt on, which has a moose on it. So that's my attempts to wrench myself into a festive spirit for this.
Nice, nice. It's been hailing here, so it's just been like getting battered with hailstones. And I have been watching, I watched Gremlins this morning. And yeah, that's how I've been getting into spooky Christmas season. So you are back on the podcast. Last time we were talking about animated horror, but this time we are getting festive, getting seasonal, and talking about two entries from the BBC's A Ghost Story for Christmas. It's four, isn't it? Not at.
Yes.
You maybe.
Yeah, yes. According to Wikipedia, it is.
Okay, A Ghost Story for Christmas. And I was inspired to ask you to do this because you recently got the box set.
I did. So I've binged them all. I hadn't watched them until last year. I saw with a festival here in Oxford that does like retrospective horror films across mm-hmm. 6 nights. And last year they did this thing where they had one of the films talking about The Signalman and Whistle and I'll Come For You, or Come To You, whichever way around it is.
these conjunction words, yeah. Whatever they're called.
And they also paired it with a ghost story read out by Adam Z. Robinson. So it's above this like old pub in Oxford. It was very creepy. And because of that, I got the box set and I've just watched them all over like 2 or 3 weeks. And like, mm-hmm. yeah, I've really got into the spirit of weird 70s British TV horror.
So last year I covered the two M.R. James ghost stories, which Whistle is one of them, and I can never remember what the other one is called because I have the worst memory.
A Warning to the Curious, is it the one about
the crown? That's the one. Thank you.
That's one of my favorites. Like I watched that and I was genuinely a bit disturbed by it because it's got some creepy imagery in it. I was a bit like, oh, okay, this is creepy.
And of course, A Ghost Story at Christmas kind of carries on the tradition of telling ghost stories at Christmas, which is what, you know, people like Charles Dickens and M.R. James did. Why do you think then, why is Christmas such a good season for ghost stories?
I mean, particularly like in this part of the world, Christmas is dark and cold and kind of strange. And like, I mean, there's the Christmas Carol thing, which is like the most famous story about Christmas is someone being visited by a trio of ghosts and the impact it has on their life. But in general, I think it's just it harkens back to like a time before proper electricity. So when everything was dark and cold and strange sounds at night and kind of unexplainable things get wrapped into these stories. And that feels like a lot of this. And then looping into this is like the M.R. James factor, whereas they BBC decided that M.R. James was perfect to be adapted. So like the first five of the Christmas ghost stories are M.R. James. And his deal is that, you know, he seems to hate academics and archaeologists and anyone who's interested in like exploring what our history is, which I mean, I kind of am on M.R. James's side because I find it a bit odd. But yeah, I think it's just that certainly from a UK perspective, we have a cold, depressing time at Christmas. Christmas is cold and depressing. And like the existence of Christmas is because it is a cold, hard time. So there was there's been like pagan festivals around this time. Every religion seems to have a moment in this part of time because otherwise we're all just going to be utterly, utterly broken by it all. And so within that kind of bleeds into like ghosts and also it's a reflective time. We're like reflecting on past, both good and bad. And the bad is that often there's sometimes trauma or guilt manifesting itself. Yeah, I think that's why ghost stories are quite popular around this time, particularly these kind of ghost stories.
Yeah, and I guess like, not to be a Debbie Downer, but like death, you know, it's the death of the old year. It's the death of the harvest, basically, if we're going to take it back to, you know, the Celtic festival of Yule. And so, yeah, it's the perfect time to also talk about dead people, I guess.
And yeah, like, I mean, like at our time recording, there's been four famous people die in one day here. Like it happens that because it is a harsher time, more people die. So death becomes more prominent. And because our landscape dies, because like all the leaves fall off, all our harvests are, we have no harvest, we have nothing growing. Everything becomes transformed and skeletal and kind of creepy, which it's nice and atmospheric, but it kind of, again, leads itself into being, it changes our moods.
Yeah. So who's died? So we've got, I'm just like side noting here. We've got I know Shane McGowan died today.
So we had Alistair Campbell, is it? The Labour Chancellor. Oh, really? Over here. Okay. Henry Kissinger, and the joke online is that Henry Kissinger has been like American people on the left in America have been rooting for his death for about 30 years and he's been like a joke. He's died, and some actor who was in Brookside. Is it Brookside?
Oh, I did see that earlier. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, it's kind of just like, I remember like there'll be like famous people have died around this time. Like I think it was, who's the chap who does the puppet? Something Anderson. He died around Christmas. And yeah, it just seems to happen. Like, because it is a cold time and like our healths are just a bit under pressure. I say this having fought a cold for like 2 weeks. So I'm a bit like, yeah, our bodies are a nightmare, aren't they? They suck. So, yeah, I think that like death is, not to be morbid, but death is everywhere at Christmas.
It really is.
Tis
the season to be jolly. they're bringing a ghost story for Christmas back, aren't they? I think me and you were discussing this a couple of weeks ago.
So they've got, funnily enough, they've got a Dickens adaptation this year, Lot Something. I forget which number the lot is, but it's adapting Dickens. They have for the last 5 years, I think it is, or 4 years, Mark Gatiss or Gatiss has been like marshalling this at the BBC. And it's been done like a couple of times. Like I had a look at the timeline and like there's been like blocks like since like the early 2000s onwards where like someone is taking this on and run of it. And like I think there's so much of these that's like influenced a certain kind like class of director, like an age group of directors clearly watched this. And like I reflect on these kind of ghost stories and their impact on something like The League of Gentlemen and like Pemberton and Shearsmith. And then there's also I think of something like Alex Garland's Men, and there's imagery in this, in one of these that I think is kind of there in his. And like the other thing is that because there's so much etched on us as a particularly where I am and like where my family are, there seems to be such history etched upon it. So it's a rich thing. Like the BBC are quite happy to have like these kind of vaguely famous people pop up in these, and it kind of like continues that tradition of these like ghost story for Christmas, which kind of were there for a few years and then seemed to end. And like one of the ones we're going to talk about, like we're talking about like the tail end of this movement. So like we've got like 6 and 7 and there's like one more after ours. But yeah, like the kind of even by our second one moved away from adapting stories to like original stories. And it's like you can feel this movement coming to an end. But then if I reflect on like other horror, these are like hugely influential. And the same way like something like Ghostwatch kind of bleeds into so much now, I think these also bleed into so much like of the last 20, 30 years, particularly the League of Gentlemen chaps.
Yeah, because it reminds me a lot of Inside Number 9. And especially like one of their Christmas specials, the one where they're in the ski lodge. That kind of like that makes me feel that this should be a ghost story for Christmas, even though it's not really a ghost story. Okay, let's kick off then. Would you like to introduce the first segment that we're going to talk about?
Yeah, so first up, we're going to talk about 1976's adaptation of The Signalman, which is based on Charles Dickens' short story of the same name. It's, as with most of these, directed by Lawrence Gordon Clark. And this, it's... none of these have like that intense plot, but this one, it's about a traveler who comes across this railway signalman, and having at first had an initially frosty encounter, it kind of blossoms into them having conversations, and the signalman is telling him of these kind of slightly strange occurrences that have happened to him whilst working them. And so signalman is someone who works in the, like, they had to have booths so they could pass messages down the line and for train travel. And so he's like positioned by this ominous tunnel in this building by himself, and strange things have been happening to him. And it kind of, there might be a specter there that is kind of warning of something bad is going to happen. And yeah, it's just basically their like conversations together. Like they have two or three conversations together and that's the film. And then it ends darkly.
Yeah, it's basically him telling the traveler a ghost story. Yeah. So I quite like this one. I think it is like properly spooky. Especially when we think about the kind of the foreshadowing of everything. So you know, the first time this guy, so it's the bell, so if there's something going on, he will hear a bell, and that is the the signal that, you know, there's something wrong with the track or the train, etc. But he's been hearing the bell when no one else can, and then he is seeing a ghost that is kind of like a in the thing, it's like a white ghost with like his hands over his face. And the first time he saw that, this signaled a train crash that happened in the tunnel.
Yeah.
And the second one, I think the second one freaked me out the most, just because it, the second time this all happens, a bride is like falls out of the train carriage somehow. I don't know how. and dies upon the tracks, and it's all very dramatic. For some reason, that one creeped me out the most. I guess because it was more like ghostly.
Yeah.
And then the third, you know, he kind of says like, "I've been hearing it again. I've been seeing things again." And it turns out it's his own death that this ghost is kind of foretelling. Do you think it's a spooky story? What did you think of it?
So I like this one. Like, so I watched it out of sync, but then I've rewatched it within the kind of journey of these stories. And one of the things I like is it's not a story about someone finding an artifact and being haunted by a spectre. This one's far more something is happening to a person that's out of their control and they're just experiencing it. And it is a creepy story, and it is these kind of stories are slow and take their time to unfurl. And I like that. I like that they take their time. I like that we have this kind of great length for these actors. And it helps that it's like the two leads are great. Like there's Dunham Elliott, who is like pops up in everything. Like he's in all these like different films. I know him from Trading Places as I think it's him, or is it Bernard Lloyd? I think it's him. So like he pops up in like Trading Places as the butler. He is in all these like rather famous films at the time. And yes, yeah, so it's got Dunham Elliott, who is the signalman, who is like doing really effective work. There's Bernard Lloyd, he is the traveler, and they're both, and I think what I liked about this is that it and with the very best of these ghost stories is that it places the weight on the actor, it places the weight on their performance, because these are quite low budget shorts that they can't do much beyond that. And then again, like I think there's like a really interesting narrative thread here that kind of bleeds across other Dickens, which is that kind of like the human impact of industrialization is felt here. So it could be just that the experience of working by this tunnel, of these like trains screeching past him periodically, of like the impact of the tunnel by him, of like these bells kind of slightly shaking and shimmering, is messing with his mind. There's nothing supernatural here. And it could just be that he's becoming a bit unwound by this, or it could be that there is something supernatural here. And I think it's a really effective story that kind of plays with what is real and what isn't. Like, what is the real horror here? And like, yeah, I think this is a good one. I think this is a good ghost story for Christmas.
Yeah, because it's a weird one, because even with his death, so it's kind of foreshadowed in the beginning. The traveler says like, "Hello down there," and that freaks him out. And then at the end, when his death is occurring, someone else says it to him to try and warn him of the oncoming train or whatever. And he's freaked out again. So you just kind of think, well, if he wasn't getting so freaked out about these things, which may or may not be real, he might have lived. You know, that kind of way, like it's a real kind of like, you know, that kind of if he was in the right mind, then he probably would have lived. And it's that real like gut punch, like meshed with this foreshadowing from the very beginning, that the traveler is almost a prediction of the end. And it just has this atmosphere as well. Like it's foggy and it's like dark and lonely and cold. And it's just real, like, it's just, as opposed to the second one we're going to talk about, it is real snuggled up in a blanket, drinking hot tea, watching this kind of, yeah, I get that like real impression from it. So yeah, I quite enjoy this. And I kind of wonder, because, you know, Charles Dickens, like with A Christmas Carol, he had like a morality tale behind it. I kind of wonder with this, whether it's about control almost. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but, you know, as a signalman, he has to have a certain level of control.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe if he'd realized that the train crash and, you know, the bride throwing herself out of the train was kind of beyond his control, he wouldn't have got so like almost driven mad by it, which led to his death. So I kind of wonder if that was like the morality tale behind this, you know, Dickens novel, or not novel, story.
Yeah, and like, I guess marrying with the control is the pressure. So it's that he's clearly been a bit warped by the pressure placed upon him. by this role. This role, like, horror, I wouldn't want his job. His job seems terrible. And, like, I think one of the things I really like is, like, the shots of him or the traveler by themselves. So, like, there's, like, what this time I noticed, like, there were shots of him sat alone in his rather depressing hut. And it's just, yeah, it feels like a lonely life, and it feels like a life where you're cut off from support structures. And the only support structure he has, this random traveler who he's talking to, who can't do anything for him, but can offer him some brief comforts. And, like, there's the actors convey a degree of chemistry between them, a sort of camaraderie that is warm and inviting, and in a place that's dark and depressing. And I've been around these old train lines, and I've been through these old train tunnels, and they're kind of grim. Like, yeah, it's kind of a grim setup. I think this is an effective little story, and, like, there is stuff there. And, like, I think that idea of control is fascinating, and I think it's, like, I think added to that is that the control is placed upon him, that it's not control he seeks, it's his job. And so it's not even that you could be like, his hubris, his arrogance is what undoes him, because that's what happens in, like, M.R. James is far more about, like, people's arrogance and hubris are what takes them out. Like, they blow in the whistle, they search for the crown, they go into some random tunnel to find some treasure. Whereas in this, there is no arrogance or hubris here. He's doing his job, and he has to do it, and he has to do this role. And so, yeah, I think this is great. And I also think this is the last of the ghost stories for Christmas that I think is great. Like, I think there's some before this that don't click with me, but this, I think, is the last of the run that I think is great. I think about half of them for me are truly interesting stories. The other half are kind of have problems or are like adaptations that are kind of reaching for something that's too far beyond them. But this, I think, because it's a simple story, effectively told. And, like, I've seen other versions of The Sigma Man.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw a version on stage earlier this year. There was a company in Oxford that put it on. And it wasn't as effective as this. I thought their location played against them because they put it in a church. So we were quite a bit more detached from it, when really it should have been in a smaller venue or a more contained venue, and we should have been right in where the signalman is.
Yeah.
And I think this uses the medium well to get into both his headspace, but also his lived space. I think it's quite good at the lived spaces before it kind of goes out into, like, the surrounding area. So because we follow the traveler, we also get, like, good shots of him walking around in his fabulous cape-like thing. I think that kind of juxtaposition between this kind of dank, dark, depressing hut and the surrounding expansive area, which is kind of also bleak. I find, like, the English countryside at winter utterly bleak. Like, I think there's some good location scouting here too, like, to commend that.
Yeah, definitely. So I take it you would recommend this.
Yeah, like, I think there's probably 3 or 4 ghost stories in this collection that are worth watching, and this is one of them.
Yeah, I definitely would, just for that, you know, it's what, like, 38 minutes, I think this one is. Like, it's real short, sweet. It grabs your attention from the get-go. It doesn't lull with, like, you know what I'm like with dialogue. I don't like my too much dialogue, but this is, you know, even though it is basically being told, it's a story being told.
Yeah.
It's not, like, heavy. So yeah, I think this is a good one for a quick ghost story on a rainy, cold night. So let's move on to the next one then, which is kind of a complete different turnaround almost.
I mean, your Inside Number 9 comparison is like, Inside Number 9 has this model to it as well, where, like, across the 6 episodes of a season, they'll do things like, I mean, like, I take the first series of Inside Number 9, where the first one is Sardines, which is set in a wardrobe, in and around a wardrobe.
It's with a great one.
Gut punch of a last reveal. The second one is set in an expansive house with no dialogue, because it's called A Quiet Night In. And then it ends, like, I remember the 6th one is a sort of strange babysitter folk horror monster upstairs that is big and baggy and then has like a really great ending. So yeah, that kind of like whiplash that takes place. Yeah. And bear in mind that before the Signalman, you got the Ash Tree, which is, I don't even like it, but it is bonkers. Like the Ash Tree is a bonkers short. So yeah, to go from the Signalman to Stigma is,
So we've got Stigma, which was from the year after the Stigma, 1977, directed, and the last one to be directed by Lawrence Gordon Clark. It was the first one to be an original story, and it was also the first one to be set in present day. So it involves this family who have newly moved to this cottage in the countryside, and it's near a megalithic stone circle. And while these workers are working in the garden, they find out that one of these stones is in the grounds of the cottage, and they dig it up. But doing this causes a curse to be released, and the wife begins to bleed, but from no wounds. And it turns out that there is also a body underneath this stone, and it was the body of a witch who had been sacrificed, and the mother is displaying the same injuries that the witch had inflicted on her. So what did you think of Stigma?
I think it's trying to do too much in the space of its like 40 minutes. Like if the Signalman benefits because it's a short story and it's a slow build into its reveal, this one just feels a bit like it's trying to do in a full film, like a full 2-hour horror in 40 minutes. And there's some other stuff. Like, I think there's some stuff in here that I find interesting. This isn't like of the movement, this is not my least favorite. Like, I think that this is okay, but I also think that there's too much here and not enough time given to like build it properly into it. But I do like the end reveal. I do like the bit where they lift up the stone and you see the body underneath. So there is stuff here, and it kind of, this one in particular helped kind of shaped my thinking of these as much as they're ghost stories. A lot of them also folk horror, like a lot of them about like unsettling something in the past, unsettling something in the soil, and that's what's causing the impact. Because this isn't a ghost story necessarily. This is, feels far more like your impact, the impact you, the forces that you mess with has an impact on you, which is like something like, it's quite M.R. James in that regard. Like, I think M.R. James would maybe not do a story exactly like this, but would do a story like this. Yeah, and there are other stuff that makes it definitely 70s to me, like the not very attractive topless men, for example, who are the builders. There is a group of builders in and we get them topless, and I'm a bit like, oh, British men, not very attractive.
Look, at least is an equal opportunities, because there's also topless women in this, topless women, so at least it's equal.
I don't know why there are topless women in this, but I also thought that of the Ash Tree, which has topless women. I assume that it's like a note from an executive at the BBC going, you know what the kids need? The kids need some topless like men and women, so let's put that in here. And like, so yeah, so like where I found the Signalman quite compelling, I don't find this that compelling, but it does have an ending that I think is interesting. It's probably just I needed it to be longer and to have more time for the characters to kind of feel like they've laid in. Like, I think it just kind of within the first 5 minutes it starts that she is having a bad time. Like, her bad time seems to start very quickly, and we don't really know who she is, and then she just won't stop bleeding or being topless.
Yeah, it just, for me, it felt very rushed, and like you said, should have been like an hour and a half film where we are being led up to the bleeding. You know, there were so many points where I was like, oh, this would have been great. Like, even when she's, you know, she's in the bathroom and she's trying to clean the blood off her, and there's all like, I know this is a typical horror trope, but she's got like these mirrors, like floor length cupboard mirrors, as were the 70s, and they're foggy. And I was like, if they had a figure just standing in the corner, like the figure of the witch or something, just standing in the corner to add that ghost kind of that ghost vibe to it, because that this was one of my problems. It's like a ghost story for Christmas, but it didn't have those ghosty vibes. And that's what I want at Christmas. I want ghosty vibes. I don't want like a sunny day in Avebury. I want like, you know.
Yeah, it's a very sunny film. It's a very brightly lit.
Yeah.
Like if the Signalman is dark and darkly lit for a lot of it, this is bright. And I mean, yeah, your point about wanting a figure there, this like her experience feels quite detached from what is under the stone. Like it's only at the end that it like reveals itself to what's under the stone, but it doesn't feel so attached to what this person's going through. It's more just for the longest time, this could just be a medical thing that she's just started bleeding and it's a medical thing. So yeah, I think this could have signposted a lot clearer to us that what is happening to her is supernatural, and that there's this like presence here that is being disturbed by them.
And I didn't even feel like the other characters were necessary, almost. Like I kind of felt like her daughter and her horrible husband, by the way, with its shitty mustache, like they were just not needed. She could have been just like a single woman. Like there was no connection. There was no like development of relationships. It was just very much like, well, they've lifted the stone and now she's going to bleed from nowhere. And I kind of feel like that bleed from nowhere, I almost would have preferred if it was like wounds had started to appear on her, I think. You know, even if we've got that original when she, like the first thing is like her hand when she's cutting vegetables and she thinks she's like cut her hand and it turns out there's no wound. If it had been that original, like, oh, she did cut her hand and she thinks it's nothing, but then all of a sudden all these wounds, like I don't know. It needed more.
Yeah, I agree. But like, I do find British folk horror fascinating. I do find just like the land that we live in Britain having, and I guess also an island, like there's like these like huge structures here, these huge stone structures that are hundreds of years old. Some of them are thousands of years old and they signify something more here. And we just build our houses wherever we want and don't really care about the consequences. Like, yeah, I like that aspect of it, but it's probably more just like I liked the vibe more than anything that this was doing. I just like a folky horror vibe as opposed to this was distinctly different. And like when watching these, I tried to have like this like thing of like a clear decline of these ghost stories, but I don't think there is, because like my least favorite is in the middle of these ghost stories. And then like the Signalman is in there, and like I think Signalman might be my second favorite of the bunch of the eight. So it's not even that I think there's like a clear decline here of this like project. It's just that it they have good years and bad years. And like I also think it doesn't help it that they have clearly decided, I assume for budgetary reasons, to do an original story. So even less so, like this feels even less connected to a ghost story at Christmas, because it's not a ghost story. It's not adapting a famous ghost story. We've kind of removed ourselves from one of the two selling points of this movement. And it's more, if anything, this is kind of like, it reminded me of like a film like Stigmata, which it's not a film I want to be reminded of because it's not very good. But yeah, just that kind of like, or like, I mean, like bits of like various occult horror. So like in like The Exorcist or The Omen, where people are like experiencing things caused by something supernatural. But I don't even think it's as good as those. Like, I don't think it's like anywhere near any of those. I mean, it's better than Exorcist 2, but a lot of things are. But yeah, it just feels like if they knew where it was going, which they did, they should have built that in more, and it should have been clearer in its like narrative that this was happening, and we should have had more information as an audience. And as you say, yeah, the daughter has nothing to do beyond occasionally look at topless builders. And the husband is just a bit of a prick. And yeah, every other character is just like, not even the lead character. She doesn't have much to do beyond experience these things. And there's some interesting stuff in the filming that it kind of is a bit experimental at times. But when you're like gestation is whistle and I'll come to you, which is super experimental and is super gets within that character's like headspace really effectively. This being a less effective version of that 10 years later. Yeah, it's kind of a shame. I was disappointed with this one.
More. Yeah. I'm trying to also work out where the title comes from as well. Stigma, like what, whether it's like...
I assume it's stigmata, but like not.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
I guess, yeah. But then again, that's like if it's a megalithic thing, then stigmata wasn't... You know, like stigmata's a Christian thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's weird. There's a lot of this segment. I'm like, I would really like this explained, please.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, is it the stigma of being, you know, a witch? Like, that's another thing. I wish that they'd kind of, like, we see all this problems, kind of relationship problems between like her and her husband. Kind of, there's a bit of thing between her and her daughter. And just if they played on that like stigma of a woman not being able to quite fit into what was presupposed for women of that time, in the sense, you know, she was meant to be, you know, a good wife, good mother. If they played a bit more on that to reflect the witch, like it just, I just feel like there were so many lost opportunities.
Yeah, like the kitchen sink stuff feels perfunctory and not necessary. Like, it doesn't feel necessary for us to know that she doesn't get on with members of her family because, hey, it's a domestic setting. We must assume that people have arguments because that's what happens to domestic settings. It's people being contained together and that's the impact. And like, I think the location's kind of creepy, but I think that of pretty much all locations they use in this run of, I think there's creepiness there, but it's undermined because it's in bright daylight. It's not even like it's misty out or anything like that. It's bright daylight, which is jarring and effective at times, but also at other times it's not. Like, horror in the sunshine can be the most effective thing, but here it just feels, I guess because it's a British 1970s TV show, it looks cheap. And this is the one I was like, this looks cheap. There are other ones, like I think The Signalman doesn't. I think like A Warning to the Curious doesn't. I think The Treasures of Abbot Thomas, they all look, they're so all, obviously all filmed on a certain grain, but they don't look cheap. And I think that also setting in modern days means that like the banality of 1970s British domestic culture. So like what was being worn, what was in the houses, what was the start of the time, really doesn't serve this well. Whereas the other ones, because they're period pieces, they kind of age less because they're already old. Like, yeah, I think I'm more damning on this because it's paired with The Signalman, and I think The Signalman's really good. And I think that The Signalman's really effective and has all these like interesting themes bubbling away in this. I'm not sure I think there are any interesting themes here outside of the standard folk horror of don't dig up stuff.
Don't fuck with old stuff.
Don't fuck with old stuff or it'll fuck with you. That's like entirely it. But like, we've had 3 or 4 stories at this point that are the exact same message done better. And it's just, yeah. And I looked into like why this was Lawrence Gordon Clark's last one. And they wanted to do another M.R. James adaptation, but it was decided it was too expensive. And it's not that he just had this falling out. It's that he was like a freelance director and was employed by ITV.
Yeah.
To go off and do stuff, so that's why he doesn't come back after this. But it feels like at this point it's kind of a bit finished. It's a bit, it's done its thing, it's done like its 5 or 6 literary ghost adaptations, that's done. And so this removes itself a bit too much from the formula. And like, we're not going to talk about it, but The Ice House doesn't go back to being about ghosts. The Ice House is not about ghosts, which is the last of the ghost stories of Christmas. And it feels also that like this loss of faith in the ghost story here, like the others are ghost stories and this is not. And it almost feels like there's a loss of faith of like telling a good ghost story, which as a fan of ghost stories, as someone who loves ghost stories, I want more ghost stories. I want them to creep me out. Ghosts are scary to me. They are one of the few things that actually frightens me. I don't quite know why. But yeah, it's scary.
Yeah. Well, so would you recommend Stigma at all to people?
I think it's interesting in like the movement of this, like of these 8 short films. I think it's interesting in that regard. It's like interesting to like observe things, like it's set in the Monday. There's nudity in it, which feels very jarring to me. But then it's also in the ash tree, there's nudity. But so it's like, it's interesting in like an academic or like as a film buff to like trace the movement of this. And I'm always fascinated like the movement of stuff. Or if you're like someone who's fascinated in about 70s British culture, because there's stuff in that here, and like you can map things onto this. But as a short ghost, well, short horror story, I don't think it's a very good short horror story. I think they're better folk horrors. I think they're better stories about women going through a supernatural experience that no one is really aware of. Yeah, this is a weaker one.
Yeah, I like the bare bones of it, but I don't think the execution was terribly successful.
Bones, do you mean the witch buried under the stone?
Literally the bare bones.
You like those bare bones?
Yeah. Like, I do like that kind of, you know. But I guess we've just been so spoiled recently, like in our time, with stuff like The Borderlands, with stuff like This Year Is The Moor, where it's that, you know, landscape horror, the horror of the landscape. That when, and even though like that wasn't a thing, you know, they were just starting with the folk horror movement around this time. But when you've got that to compare to, it's just like, it's hard not to be like, you know.
Yeah. And I think The Moor is a good comparison, because that is also about a dead body out there. I mean, they're trying to find it, but it's, both sets of people are impacted by this dead body. The Moor is terrifying, terrifyingly effective and terrifying. And like your point about folk horror, like folk horror feels like an organic subgenre as opposed to one created. It feels like it's like these threads like that come from a cult or ghost stories kind of bleed into this this subgenre of folk horror, as opposed to like zombies, which have like specific things making a zombie film. And like folk horror, it's kind of more of a vibe, it's more of a feel. I think like the Ghost Stories of Christmas are hugely influential. I don't think Stigma is one of those that's hugely influential. I can imagine like the League of Gentlemen Chaps, the Edgar Wrights of the world, the Alex Garland's sat watching these over Christmas, but I don't think this is the one they remember. It will be stuff like The Signalman, like a Warning to the Curious, like any number of the other ones.
Yeah.
But as I say, this isn't my least favorite. I probably dislike The Ice House more, and I really didn't get on board with The Ash Tree. So like, I just think that this is almost too slight, a short film for me. It's almost too slight. Like, it needs that time to expand on itself. And so it just becomes a sort of Spark Notes, M.R. James-like story.
So I take it out of the two of them, if you had to recommend one of the other, it'd be The Signalman.
Definitely The Signalman. Like, I've watched The Signalman twice now, and both times I was creeped out by it. Both times I was drawn in to its narrative. And like, I'm going to pick up a couple of these every year now and watch them as like a little tradition to myself. And The Signalman is the one I'll be part of that. Like, I think The Signalman is genuinely great.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. Have you seen any of the more modern ones from 2005 onwards?
I have not, but I'm going to make it my mission to go in and find them. So like, I'm just looking at it now. So like, in 2013, we had they did an M.R. James adaptation of the Tractate Midas, which I don't know what that is. But then from like 2018 onwards, it's like there's one that isn't an adaptation, and then there's like Martin's Close, which is M.R. James, the Mezzanite, which is M.R. James, the Count Magnus. I think Count Magnus might be the one they wanted to adapt, but they couldn't do it because of cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's November James. And then they're on to like lot number 249, which is Arthur Conan Doyle. And so I feel I should, for myself, because I do like these spooky ghost stories, go off and take a watch of these.
Yeah, I'm of the same. Like, I do want to go back and see them, especially. So they did A View from a Hill in 2005, and I want to see an adaptation. It's just because it was a graphic design project for me back in college, so I'm like, oh, I should go and watch that. Yeah, and especially they did a remake of Whistle and I'll Come to You in 2010 with John Hurt, which would be interesting to see. So yeah, I'm definitely going to go back and try and find these somehow.
I'll definitely try and watch them. And like where I am in terms of my festiveness is that I'd rather watch Christmas horror right now. And then the nearer the time I get, I'll be like, no, now it's time for It's a Wonderful Life or Elf or one of those like ones. Yeah. But right now I'm like, I want to watch people suffer at Christmas. That's what I want.
Nice. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting about these two, A Ghost Story for Christmas.
No, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, it was really fun to talk about them.
Good. And before we go, what would be your Christmas horror recommendation?
Oh, okay. So in terms of new releases, I'm very excited for It's a Wonderful Knife, which I broadly on board with slasherizing beloved films. So like, be it Back to the Future, be it Freaky Friday, be it Groundhog Day, or in this case, It's a Wonderful Life. I am excited for that. In terms of what I watch, like obviously Gremlins and Black Christmas are in the mix. I rewatched The Leech the other day, which came out last year.
Oh, I must rewatch that.
And it's as nasty and mean-spirited as ever. And I think it's fabulous. I think if you haven't seen it last year, go watch The Leech.
Yep.
Obviously Black Christmas, and only the original Black Christmas. I don't have a massive issue. I thought the 2019 one was fine, if somewhat gentle. I can't stand the 2006 one, I think.
I literally just watched that last night because I was looking for the original, couldn't find it anywhere. I found the 2006 version. I didn't mind it. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be like really bad, like awful. And it, to be honest, it wasn't as bad as I thought it'd be. Like, it's not great, but it's not.
I think I'm slightly allergic to that kind of American 2000s remake.
Yeah.
And it's not the worst of the bunch. The worst of the bunch is The Hitcher, because it takes on one of my favorite horrors and makes it less nasty, which is... Yeah. So watch the original Black Christmas, because it's profoundly mean-spirited. And it's not quite a horror, but it is my beloved. So I'll say Batman Returns, because I love Batman Returns. It is my Christmas film. And like, Burton draws off like the gothic Universal monster movies a lot in like his early stuff, and it's in there, particularly with Danny DeVito's Penguin. It could be a Universal monster if we stripped away the fact he's a massive sex pest. So
so where can people find you online if they want to?
So if you want to, I'm on, I think, most things now as Russ Loves Movies. I post periodically stuff. I end up guesting on people's podcasts or writing for other people. And my one is Not Just for Kids. What am I covering this month? So you came on in my last episode, which was Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, which was a great chat. And then we've got, you're coming back on at Christmas. For Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and A Christmas Horror Story, I think is your other one. So I've done a series of naughty and nice episodes with like writers from Ghouls Magazine. And I'm actually going to do some episodes on these ghost stories that we've covered now. Like, I'm going to do a couple of like just quick 30-minute episodes covering a couple of stories. And then at the end of the year, I'm going to do Return of the King. And then next year, when I get back onto modern animation, I will cover like the four or five animations from this year that I think need talking about, like the Puss in Boots, Twos, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the Boy and the Heron, all of those, I'll do like episodes on those, chatting about them, because animation is still in a fabulous place in spite of I think Disney's side of things are a bit boring, but like if you scrape away from those, you get like some really great animations out there.
Great. Look forward to hearing this. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'll say Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Russ.
So that was my chat there with Russ Bailey about two entries in the A Ghost Story for Christmas series, which was The Signal Man, originally done by Charles Dickens, which aired in 1976, as well as Stigma, which aired in 1977. Let me know, what did you think of this week's episode? Do you like A Ghost Story for Christmas? It kind of feels like it's not quite Christmas without a spooky ghost story to go along with it. Check me out on Twitter @what_scream, Instagram @what_scream. And don't forget to rate, review, subscribe on whatever podcast platform you are listening to me on. Now, I have one episode left of season 2 of What a Scream, and then I will be taking a break before launching back into season 3 in February. I need a break. I've seen so many films this year. And I'm really excited for season 3. We have some bangers coming up. So next week is the last episode of season 2. Myself and Elaine Pascal will be talking about Shirley Jackson films. So films that have been adapted from Shirley Jackson stories. So yes, that'll be the very last episode, as I said. So until then, don't forget to stay horrific and goodbye.